From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are halfway through the year, which means we've had a couple hundred conversations so far on Insight. It's a great time to listen back to some of the most interesting interviews we've had on the show. We're starting off with a hard look at the tough decisions families had to make during last year's infant formula shortage. Due to supply chain and production issues, coupled with a recall, the formula shelf was empty in about 70% of stores across the country, and that was back in May of 2022. And in California, the out-of-stock rate reached 90%. This left families and caregivers in an anxious search for formula. One of those mothers was Jennifer Hahn Holbrook, a mother of two and a professor at UC Merced who studies the psychology of breastfeeding. Her experience motivated her to conduct a nationwide study on the impact of the formula shortage on families. I spoke with Professor Hahn Holbrook about the difficult decisions families had to make to feed their babies. Starting off, what led to a career into the psychology of breastfeeding?
You know, I think I'm an explorer by nature, and really there's not a lot of research on how psychology and biology interact during pregnancy, but also during lactation. And also, human milk is just endlessly fascinating for me. I'm a bio geek, and I love it.
You're also the director of the Latch Lab at UC Merced. Tell us more about the work that you and your colleagues do there.
Sure. So we study how psychological factors like stress and social support could influence mother's hormones in pregnancy, or even the hormone levels in her milk, and then how that in turn influences infant development. So we look at infant temperament, infant obesity risk, lots of factors. And human milk's just amazing because it's not just nutrition, but it's also information in the form of hormones, and also medicine in the form of antibodies and things like that. So that's just some examples of what we do.
I mean, you just laid out a lot of information that I would imagine isn't explained to families before they embark on parenthood and breastfeeding.
Yeah, I think we think of human milk as nutrition often, but it is so much more. But I obviously also just, my career was first and foremost, I want to make sure every baby and mother have the best possible start in life. And so that's my career goal, what I've dedicated my life to. And so in that, I want babies to be fed. And a lot of babies, you know, are not going to be able to be breastfed, whether for surgical reasons or because of, you know, the mom has to go back to work and the job's not flexible. We don't have paid maternity leave in this country. So I want to ensure that every baby's fed and every mom and baby, you know, feel supported and cared for and have the best possible start. So formula, you know, is a good thing too. So that's one of the reasons why we did this big study on formula shortages.
Yeah, a study that was also shaped by your own personal experience searching for formula for your own infant during this shortage, right?
Yeah, like many families out there, it was hard during the COVID-19 lockdowns. And I think a lot of adults will remember, you know, going to the grocery store and rice and beans and bread would be sold out. And that's okay, because you could do like potatoes or corn or another thing. But what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, infants can only eat one of two things for the first 5 months of their life, either human milk or infant formula. And so there wasn't any options for formula-fed babies. So my baby actually had a rare form of jaundice that made it so health-wise, I was breastfeeding, but he also needed formula. And my little angel, you know, was having bottles every day. And I had a lot of trouble finding infant formula. I'd go to the store, it'd be sold out. I was lucky enough to have a car so I could drive to multiple stores. I was lucky enough to have the money so I could spend, you know, 200% more on some organic brand of formula I'd never tried. And so I had to switch formula brands, and baby was not happy with that, you know, caused some upset and so a little bit of diarrhea, but we were okay. But a lot of families struggled, mm-hmm. including me.
I have a lot of friends who during that time, they were just going from store to store looking for formula. They were spending so much money and already, you know, strapped for cash, you know, at that.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to breastfeeding versus formula, I mean, How common is it to be able to breastfeed full time without relying on formula? Or do the majority of mothers need formula at some point, especially in the first 5 months?
Yeah, the majority of families in the US, 3 out of every 4 will have to use formula at some point. Only 25% make it to the kind of the ideal from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is to feed your baby nothing but human milk for the first 5 months of life. And the reasons for that are complex, but mostly it's because of lack of lactation support. So breastfeeding is actually really hard. And it's not just something that's easy and natural. You need a lot of medical help. Another thing, and health insurance is so piecemeal in the US. Some people have great lactation support covered by their insurance, but a lot of people don't. And then another huge factor is obviously no paid maternity leave in the United States. So exclusively breastfeeding can take, you know, anywhere from 4 to 7 hours a day. That's like a part-time or full-time job.
Yeah.
And so who's going to, you know, mom can't just sit at home not making money in most families. So, you know, we're not mom blaming here at all. That's the number one thing. It's these systemic issues. And so, yeah, the United States has some of the lowest breastfeeding rates in the developed world because of our piecemeal health insurance system and our lack of paid maternity leave.
How did you conduct the survey? How wide of a net did you cast for respondents?
Yeah, so we surveyed 319 families who were caregivers of infants at least some point during the pandemic. It's important to note that this was not a nationally representative study. We were just scrambling as a lab to kind of, with the shutdowns, figure out what to research. And one of my undergrads actually brought up this idea, and it immediately resonated with me because of my own experience. So we just used snowball sampling, like put it up on Facebook, put it up on Twitter, tried to get people to spread the word. We also used Amazon Mechanical Turk to get some participants. And we just asked some really basic questions about, number one, kind of, how hard was it for you to find infant formula or the breastfeeding support you needed? We also asked about that. And then if you did have trouble or made changes to the way you fed your baby because of issues that came up with the pandemic, what did you do? And that was really the biggest missing piece. Like nobody had really asked, everyone's freaking out about the formula shortages, but no one had really asked, okay, what did families do when there was no formula? And the answer wasn't good.
Yeah, I would imagine when you're doing the survey and you're getting the responses, especially because you had that very intimate experience as a mother looking for formula as well during that time, that a lot of it, or maybe some of it, was confirmation of your own personal experience. But you talk about that missing piece. What surprised you most in the responses of people of what they had to resort to, given that they couldn't have reliable access or affordable access to formula?
Yeah, I guess, unfortunately, I wasn't surprised by our results. So 1 in 3 formula feeding families ended up using a potentially dangerous feeding practice because they didn't have access to infant formula. So those dangerous practices included things like formula thinning. So 11% of our formula feeding families were trying to stretch formula. So that means they put, you know, a little extra water in the bottle, a lot of extra water in the bottle because they only had one jar of formula left. And what are you going to do? And so I guess that was not that surprising. I guess one of the surprising things for me was how widespread it is. So yes, it was true that low-income families and food insecure families were much more likely to kind of have to resort to formula thinning practices and these potentially dangerous formula feeding practices, but it was really widespread. And even some of our wealthier families had a hard time as well. But it wasn't just an inconvenience for families. You know, it wasn't like you could just go to another store. Sometimes there were some families who just couldn't access formula. And that was really, really sad.
What are the potential long-term health impacts by, you know, adding more water to formula or going longer between feedings?
Yeah, so there's a lot of really negative health effects. So with regards to formula thinning, it obviously is giving the infant less calories than they need. And the babies are growing very, 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 very quickly. And so, with that, you can cause long-term health impacts for the infant's development as they grow. So, you could have deficits in cognition throughout the lifespan, problems with cardiovascular disease throughout the lifespan, troubles with obviously in yeah. So, there's short and long-term consequences. In the short term, obviously, malnutrition, hunger, in extreme cases, it can even lead to death. Some families also kind of tried to get creative and, put in rice cereal or things like that into the bottles. That's also a really bad idea, especially for the youngest infants, because it's related to choking deaths. Infants are not ready to drink, these globs of things. It's related to a lot of diarrhea and gastrointestinal problems. And when infants' systems are so delicate that even just giving a few bottles of water or juice instead of formula can lead to electrolyte imbalances and cause like seizures and problems even immediately. So it's really important that infants, when you're mixing formula, to mix it properly. And obviously, we're not parent blaming here because what were families supposed to do? I mean, and we need to make sure that, no family anywhere in the world, but especially in the United States, ever has to face that difficult decision of what am I going to feed my infant today?
Well, turning to solutions, I mean, at least in the immediacy, the recall of some of those formula products, I mean, it just compounded the supply crisis. At that time, the Biden administration did take action to improve the supply chain for infant formula. But what other steps do you believe should be taken on a state and a federal level?
Yeah. Over the long term, I think we need to invest in breastfeeding. Breastfeeding families were obviously, insulated from these formula shortages. But that's a longer term goal, and that would involve paid maternity leave and better lactation support are the two things we need to do. There was always going to be those infants, though, that cannot be breastfed. So we also need to ensure good access to formula for those infants. So for that, at the kind of national level, I think just like we have backups of kind of insulin and things like that, preparing for disasters, we need to have like a really good emergency plan for times like this. And I think the US was kind of caught with its pants down a little bit in the fact that here's this emergency and we didn't really have proper backups. Another thing that's good is the Women, Infant, and Children's Program, WIC, became a lot more flexible. So that's a food program for our lowest income families. And it did become a lot more flexible so that you're able to buy like different brands. It used to be that you could only get the one brand, and that's going to obviously be sold out the fastest. So it's a lot, and they didn't allow online ordering. So kind of keeping those flexibility in our current kind of food security net would be a really great idea. And then finally, we need to educate families on, how dangerous it is to use these deleterious feeding practices and what you can do. Like a lot of families didn't know that it was okay to switch formula brands. They were like, oh. Or a lot of families didn't know that, like the Women, Infant, and Children's Program or their local hospital or their pediatrician can kind of help get you access to formula in emergencies too. So, and what you don't want to do is be mixing your own formula. And I think just a lot of just education for parents would be really helpful that it's absolutely not a good idea to feed your infant juice or cow's milk if they're 2, 3 months old. It's dangerous for their electrolyte balance and their short and long-term health.
Right. I mean, especially when you just talked about, cow's milk and also not having water as well in the first months. I mean, these in the immediacy, what can be done to better educate families and new parents about that you can switch formula and, and things that could be pretty easy and at times critical fixes, but you don't know what you don't know.
I think in the US, we really like to focus on individual solutions because we like to have kind of the power. But I think what this formula shortage shows was, that sometimes we do need kind of more sweeping solutions. So if you're running out of formula, right, I'm not going to blame any parent who, had to resort to one of these feeding practices. I would recommend, if you're running low on formula, contact your pediatrician if you have one. Contact your local hospital. Contact the local Women, Infant, and Children's Center in your community. They can help you get formula and also switch brands. You know, that is the safest solution, and that's okay. So it's obviously more difficult, though, for families. Some infants, because of their genetic makeup or health issues, can only drink kind of specialty formulas. And so those, you know, parents are going to have a harder time. Also, at the store level, this was something I saw because even before the formula shortages became kind of everyone was aware of them, they were happening in waves as COVID was happening because everyone would freak out because of COVID and then go hoard a bunch of stuff, buy 10 jars of formula, just like you were buying all the rice to just in case,
And
right?
toilet
Kind of this
paper, right?
apocalypse
Yeah.
mindset. So if stores could have kind of limits on the amount of formula that you can buy, only one or two, you know, not 10, so that richer families don't hoard all the formula and, you know, keeping it away from the families that don't have, you know, formula is very expensive, you know, $500 to spend on formula this month. I mean, that is not an outrageous sum. That's what, you know, people were doing. And so limiting that at the store level would be really good.
You also stated, I found this interesting, that climate change will likely increase the potential for more disruptions to formula supply. How so?
Yeah, so in natural disasters in general, which are going to become more common as we see because of the warming atmosphere, it's going to cause more fluctuations and storms, which is going to both lead to this kind of feast or famine in terms of rainfall. You're either in a drought or you get these like storm after storm after storm, like you were just talking about. That can, you know, wash out roads, that can turn over shipping containers, that can make it so ingredients that we need to make infant formula can't get to the factories that they need to get to. Also just think about if you have a fire and you're stuck in your house or you're in an evacuation center, right? We oftentimes forget about the infants. We forget about the newborns. So we've got the granola bars and the canned food, but we don't have the canned formula at that place. So those are some of the ways natural disaster just causes chaos. And if you don't have access to clean water and, you know, infant formula and also the bottles you need, all the supplies you need to feed the babies, then baby's not going to get fed if they're formula fed. So, yeah, I think this was a great opportunity for the US to kind of wake up and realize that this is a vulnerability. And I really don't think one thing I love about studying this is everybody can agree, Republican, Democrat, that babies should be fed, you know? And so one of the things I love about my research is it kind of brings everybody together. So let's come up with a plan, an emergency plan, so this doesn't become an issue again.
Jennifer, thank you so much. I mean, you and the people at the Latch Lab, I mean, we just hit the tip of the iceberg. We could have kept talking and talking and talking with all the fascinating work that you're doing.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jennifer Hahn Holbrook is a professor of psychology at UC Merced and director of the university's Latch Laboratory, sharing her research on the impact of last year's infant formula shortage on families across the country. Up next, Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao is the first Hmong to lead a major U.S. city. Born and raised in Stockton, the mayor shares how overcoming poverty, domestic violence, and homelessness shaped her approach to leading one of the largest cities in California. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao is leading one of the largest cities in California. At 38 years old, Mayor Tao is the first Hmong to lead a major U.S. city. Born and raised in Stockton, Tao's family shares a history of becoming refugees, escaping genocide during the Vietnam War. An immigration story that also includes overcoming poverty, violence, and homelessness before becoming Oakland's 51st mayor. I spoke with Mayor Tao about how her Hmong American journey shaped her approach to leadership. So I want to start before you were even born, because we are often shaped by the generations that precede us, especially when it comes to our parents. How did your parents' journey to the U.S. and California shape you?
You know, it's very interesting. Growing up, they didn't even talk about, you know, all of the things that they had to go through. It was actually not until I was at UC Berkeley, and I decided that I really wanted to understand better through their lens all the journey that they went through escaping genocide. And so I kind of lied to them and said that I had this book report and that they, you know, and I had to ask them all these questions. And so that was when the first time I realized that there was so much trauma that they had to go through, right? And so for my mom, so the Hmong people, they live in the mountains of, majority of them live in the mountains of Laos. And my parents, my father was an orphan and he lived on a different mountain relative to my mom. And my mom was what you would consider a little bit wealthier in the sense because she had family. And Hmong people, they live off of the land. And so with that being said, my mom was pregnant when the war started, and she had also had an infant. Her first husband died in the war and she had to escape. And the stories they told about how so many mothers had to feed their babies opium so that they would not cry while trying to run through the jungles to escape genocide, and sometimes giving a little bit too much opium and the babies would never wake up. And it's heart-wrenching, right? It's heart-wrenching to see that so much death was actually their reality because of war and what war did. And so, you know, my mom, she was shot in the arm. She still carries that bullet in her arm to this day. My parents, you know, my father, his journey was a little different. He was an orphan. And so he knew how to swim, and he swam a lot of people across the Mekong River so that they could get to the Thailand refugee camps. And so my parents did meet in the refugee camps, and, you know, it wasn't love at first sight at all. It was more of a survival technique where the community said, look, you're an orphan and you know, to my mom, you know, you're a widow with, you know, now two infant children and your mother-in-law, you both should just get together, become a unit and go to the new world and try to survive and make it. And so that's the story of my parents and how that shaped me growing up. It was that, you know, there was not a lot of lovey-dovey, you know, a romance going on with my parents, but it was just a sense of survival the whole time. Now that I understand the relationship a little bit better, but, you know, it worked. And over time, they learned how to be best partners to each other in that sense. But, you know, and then for my father, being an orphan and coming to the United States, really demasculating what he can do to provide for his family, being that he couldn't speak the language, didn't have any skills, trades, or the, you know, no one was formally educated. My mom is illiterate. She can't even read the Hmong language because Hmong language is just heaven. It's a new language that was actually produced by missionaries. And so, you know, so it was difficult growing up because their frustration, of course, with 10 children too, you know, sometimes we got the brunt of that frustration.
Yeah. I would imagine, given that you learned that as a young adult, as a college student at UC Berkeley, that must have deepened your own understanding of your own childhood.
Absolutely. It, you know, for a very long time growing up, I did not feel loved, and I did not feel as if my parents were the best parents, you know, and no one's perfect. But, you know, as a young adult, I didn't realize that it was all this trauma, right? We talk about PTSD all the time. We talk about intergenerational trauma. Imagine going through genocide, running in the jungles for your life when you could only run at night. Because if anybody saw you in the daytime, they would shoot you dead on site. And then seeing death everywhere, and then crossing the Mekong River, which is Russian River, and then living in a refugee camp, you know, not knowing where you're going to be actually planting your roots, then coming to a new world where you don't even know the language, you're seeing people who look different outside of what you are used to seeing for the first time. You know, I remember a story when my dad said, you know, he saw the first Black person ever, the first Latinx person ever. And I asked him, you know, how did you feel about it? He was like, well, I felt like they were the same as we were, because for whatever reason, they were all in the social services line with us. And we just had a sense that there was white superiority because it was mainly people who had color on them that were in these lines. And so it was difficult growing up, but then in hindsight, it's like, now I get it. I get it. They never got treatment or was given services for their PTSD, even to this day, right? No one said that they, you know, my parents said, no one actively came to say you could go get an education. So the assumption was we have to, you know, my mother had to be a stay-at-home mom. And so it's so much more that the government could have done.
When you arrived to the Central Valley, to Stockton, were you surrounded by a Hmong community growing up, or was it just you and your family, and a large one at that, 10 children?
So I was actually born and raised in Stockton, California, and my parents actually, my father, all I can remember was growing up outside of the Hmong community. We lived on the outskirts of Stockton, away from the Hmong community, and I remember early on my father saying that was because he saw other young Hmong boys join gangs to help, you know, find some semblance of family and identity in this new world called the United States of America. And so my father moved us out into a predominantly white neighborhood so that my brothers wouldn't join the gangs. And so, you know, I could see a little bit of a heartache in my dad today because we were not born and raised around our, you know, other Hmong families. You know, we didn't grow up having a lot of Hmong friends.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that story resonates with a lot of people who have a family story of immigration and leaving their homeland for a safer life. Given that as you got older, your teenage years into young adulthood were difficult, to say the least. How were those initial years when you moved away from your family who lived in Stockton to the Bay Area? How did that shape you?
Yeah, you know, like I said earlier, I felt like I, you know, I just knew that, you know, how I was being treated at home, I didn't like it. I didn't like the fact that it was so gender-based. You know, the patriarchy within the Hmong community runs really deep. In hindsight, you know, my parents were raising their kids the only way they knew how, you know, the way that it worked in the homeland. And so I was a little bit rebellious in the sense that I demanded that if my brothers weren't going to wake up at 6 a.m., which was required of any of the daughters to cook and clean, then I wasn't going to do it either. And so I was rebellious since an early age. And so when I left the house because, you know, of what I felt was emotional abuse and sometimes physical abuse, you know, I left because I was also trying to find, you know, who am I, right? I'm at home, I'm Hmong. And then, you know, when I go to school, I'm this Hmong American person. And what does that mean? And so when I left, and, you know, I couch surfed and I, you know, one of my girlfriends, I remember her mother dressed up and left and went back to Cambodia. And so she was living in Section 8 housing and she just had the home to herself. And so that's where all the kids who kind of wanted to leave their house kind of hung out. But we still went to school. We parented each other. And then from that point, moving to the Bay Area, after graduating high school, you know, I was in a relationship with my son's father, and that was quickly, you know, it wasn't like 3 months in, and I was in a, you know, what I didn't know then was I, you know, was a domestic violence relationship. That was my very first serious, real relationship. And so.
And you were pregnant at the time, correct?
Well, no, I was with him for about 4 years and then I became pregnant. And when I became pregnant, so I was with him for 4 years, 6 months pregnant. I still remember that day so clearly. He grabs me by my hair while I was sitting on the bed and pulls me down. He was upset that, you know, he was going to go out and I don't know what he was going to do. And so I asked him to stay and he wasn't happy about that. So he pulled my hair and dragged me to the floor, and he just started kicking me, you know, and I was 6 months pregnant with his child. All I remember was protecting my stomach and just begging for him to leave. I'm like, okay, just go. And then he left. And that was when I realized, like, you know what, like, I don't want my son, my unborn child, to grow up this way. And by that time, you know, in any abusive relationship, of course, I don't have any more friends. My family has been cut off for many, many years. And so I was 20 years old and feeling very shameful and embarrassed, because I felt like I chose him over everybody else. And so how can anybody, you know, how dare I call anybody for help when, like, I chose this man, right? And quite honestly, I thought I was in such a unique situation, you know, being a 20-year-old. And I was embarrassed of the situation, because here I am, this rebellious, strong young girl who's like, no, you know, break the patriarchy. And, you know, was like president of the Key Club, which is a service club, for years in high school. Like, how do I get into this situation? And anybody can, right? And so, with that being said, you know, I left and I didn't have a place to live. So I was, again, couch surfing wherever. I mainly lived in my vehicle. I gave birth at the county hospital where, you know, I got a car seat that was donated. I still remember to this day, the car seat was one of those very hard plastic old car seats. And I was just so happy that somebody would give me a car seat. And then even then, I had to ask a stranger to take me to someone that I had met's house. And then from there, you know, I remember the nurses being really concerned about the fact that they saw nobody come and visit me. And they kind of followed me around for about 2 weeks. And it was truly the nurses who taught me how to breastfeed my child, how to bathe my child. And, you know, I'm a 20-year-old mom. You need a lot of support and help too, you know, and so and made sure that I was had the mental capacity to do it. And so I don't know how those, you know, if it was in their work description, but I'm just so thankful for those nurses. And I can't remember their names at all. I wish I could, but it was also through donation of retirees who were knitting clothes for babies. I used those clothes and I still have them to this day. And so, you know, it's small things like that that really goes a long way. And people don't understand how, you know, that it goes a long way for those who are needing.
Yeah, I mean, when you say it goes a long way, I mean, you went from those experiences to attending community college with an infant, you transferred to UC Berkeley, you became a city council member eventually, and then now you're the mayor of Oakland. And these experiences have become formative in your policies. But how do you feel your immigrant story and your racial identity has played a role in how you've come to this mayoral seat and what you want to accomplish?
Right. I mean, you know, if I can just talk about getting into politics, you know, it was just, to be honest, an accident in that sense. I was actually I was a legal studies major and I was headed off to law school. That was the plan, but I couldn't afford to pay for my son's clothes as he was outgrowing it so quickly as a single mom at UC Berkeley. And so, you know, I took on this internship through this program called APAPA. APAPA really tries to get APIs into local government and do exactly what I'm doing today is get into politics. I was not thinking about politics. To be quite honest with you, I had no clue what the word politics really meant. I didn't even really know what local government really did. You know, I think we had one semester of lessons, like, I don't know, maybe middle school or high school. And I took the internship because they paid me $1,000 and I needed it. And they paired me up with the Oakland council member at large. And that's when I realized, like, oh my goodness, all of these policymakers who are creating policies for everyday people, working people who have no time to show up to these council meetings that they have every Tuesdays and Thursdays, that we have to live by those, you know, those policies and those rules. And yet they have no lived life experience. How would they know the negative consequences that they are creating through what through the policies that they're implementing, which looks good on paper, right? And so that was the start of, like, my passion for this is, you know, I need to be here to advocate for those For those who are living on the margins, I didn't want to be the change factor after the fact. I wanted to be the change factor in the forefront. And so when I jokingly say, when I met local government, I knew that that's where where my passion is. And so I started off as a staffer, and I never knew that, and never thought and dreamt that I would ever be an elected official, because I didn't see elected officials that looked like me, right? At the time, I was still a single mom, barely making rent as a city staffer, barely making rent. And to me, an elected official comes from money. To me, an elected official is more privileged in the sense of their skin tone, right? Looks a lot whiter than my skin. An elected official is somebody who understood, and understood politics and government inside and out, and have been studying it for decades. That's all what I thought an elected official is. And so, to run in 2018, I did, for the first week, try to be a politician. I fell flat on my face. I don't know what I was trying to do. And then I just looked at myself in the mirror and was like, Shang, you know what? You've come so far. Like, who gives a damn? Like, go and be you. Go and be you. And if they like you and they know that you can advocate for them because you've been advocating your whole life, then they would pick you to represent them. And that was actually when I fell in love with myself. When I fell in love with myself was when I was so true and so raw. I started talking about my DV experience. And, men came up to me and said, well, you shouldn't talk about that because it makes you look like you're asking for, sympathy. And I'm like, well, then in that case, don't vote for me. And number two, I'm going to keep talking about it just because you, a man, had told me that. And for every man that told me that, I had like 10 more women who said, hey, I'm going through the same thing, or I've gone through it. You're an inspiration. And so for me, how that shaped, being an API woman and a Southeast Asian woman, being the first Hmong, now the first Hmong mayor of a major city, it's huge. And this is what representation means, right? I got it wrong the first time around. Right. The first time around of like, oh, well, it needs to be a privileged person. No, absolutely not. Our elected officials need to have lived life experiences. They, that's how we create impactful policies, because I'm a true believer of lifting from the bottom up. And so, if we can lift from the bottom and make sure that those who are living on the margins have a better quality of life, we're all going to be better for it.
Mayor Tao, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That is Oakland Mayor Shang Tao, who is the first Hmong to lead a major U.S. city, sharing how her family journey fleeing genocide during the Vietnam War and her own personal journey overcoming domestic violence and homelessness has shaped her approach to leading one of the largest cities in California. Still ahead, we'll meet a student who is teaching finances to peers so teens get a head start in understanding the world of loans, credit cards, and overdraft fees instead of learning the hard way as adults. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to a special best-of edition of Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're closing our show taking a listen back to some of the most interesting conversations this year. And that brings us to an El Dorado County student who is passionate about educating teens in the world of finance. From college loans to credit cards and overdraft fees, navigating the transition from high school to adulthood, can come with some hard learning lessons and costly consequences. Sean Varshney is an Oak Ridge High School student and co-founder of Financial Literacy for You, a peer-to-peer nonprofit working to address the need for financial literacy. This is so cool, what you created, what you co-founded, Financial Literacy for You, also known as FLY. It was founded in 2018. How did this start? Where did it begin?
Yeah, so it all really started with my brother and I, who's currently a junior right now in college. We kind of saw what was happening, what the school curriculum at our local high school, as well as middle school, and kind of just taking different trips to parts of Sacramento, and you see the amount of extreme poverty in many cases. You begin to question where that all really started. And that's the same question that my brother and I had. We saw the poverty issue as something that we felt really passionate about, and we figured out how can this be addressed. So we looked into everything, and we figured out that the biggest issue that's really causing the whole poverty kind of happening in the first place is financial illiteracy. And it's simply the case of people not being able to know simple budgeting skills or what to do with their money. So once we figured that out, we said, hey, here's a great opportunity to kind of educate the future generation and kind of prevent some of these kind of mishappenings in the future. And that's all tackled with financial literacy. And then that's where FLY was started. And we began doing lessons at middle schools, boys and girls clubs, high schools, and we're teaching exactly what financial literacy is. You know, you've talked about budgeting, and you're talking about credit, investing, college loans, any of those types of things that are so crucial for later adulthood. We're exposing to you to kind of help them bridge that gap between the resources that they wouldn't be given at school and resources that they're absolutely going to need in the future. And then that's where we come in, and we kind of provide those lessons.
So you clearly had a foundation of financial literacy. That's what led to you to even recognize that there was a problem, a gap that you and your brother wanted to fill. Where did that foundation come from?
Yeah, so that foundation really came from my dad, who's in the business and investments industry. I've kind of watched him throughout my whole life, watching investment moves and kind of CNBC on TV. And I've seen, you know, how to invest, where money comes from, how do you save, how do you set long-term goals for saving, how do you potentially make a college savings account. So my dad has really been the main influencer for both of us. And he's kind of gotten us exposed to many of these skills that we're now bringing to many youth at a very young age. And I've something that I've always been extremely passionate about, giving back to the community and also teaching financial skills, whether it be investing, budgeting, kind of managing future goals. That's always been something that we've been really excited about. And then that's how that led to our interest to start FLY.
When did you start, I guess, saving and budgeting? How young were you when you started really thinking about this, especially, you know, since you have your father who, you know, who works in this field?
Yeah, so I've been budgeting and saving and doing all those types of activities really since the second grade. I opened up my own portfolio back in sixth grade for investments on E-Trade, and then I was trading stocks and everything like that. But if you're just talking about general kind of knowledge about financial literacy, things like saving up for loans, how to apply for a loan, how to manage credit, what is a credit card, I really began all those types of skills after second grade.
I'm like visualizing a double screen, Sean, of you in second grade and me in second grade. And we had a very different set of awareness when it came to financial literacy, even into adulthood and going into college. What I also love about your organization is you go to the website and you see who these instructors are and their students as well. What is the benefit of having peers mentor others in financial literacy?
Yeah, it's major for the reason that instead of an adult kind of trying to teach these students about, hey, you know, this is how you start savings for college. This is how you actually go to a car dealership And you can bargain. You can try and get the best deal that you can on a car. These are the different metrics that you want to look at. This is how you maybe create a long-term financing plan. Instead of an adult teaching it to them and kind of an almost boring way where you're kind of listening to somebody just giving straight, explaining advice to you, we actually have engaging lessons where we have activities like Kahoots. We're asking questions back and forth between the students, and they're likely to participate too, because we also give prizes for the people that do speak back. And the most important part about all of the lessons is that this is a youth-to-youth kind of interface where we are students teaching other students, and they feel that they are able to ask questions. They are able to kind of present themselves in a way where they want to learn, and we're helping them, we're guiding them as a friend instead of kind of a mentor or a teacher, as it may be if somebody older might have been teaching it to them. So they definitely feel that since we're there as a friend, we're both learning together, and then they're more obligated to kind of enjoy the experience, engage more because they're not afraid to ask questions. And then all of our team members are learning as well in the process. So it's fantastic. It really works out great for all of us, and especially our constituents who are at the lessons, because like I said, they love kind of the games and everything that we do during the lessons, and it reinforces their own knowledge base, and then they ask questions. So,
you know, you all may be peers and around the same age, but you all come from different lived experiences, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and different challenges within the home. Given, like, I know you are well aware, I mean, there's the rising cost for gas, eggs, housing, many families struggling. How can a young person even begin to even think about financial literacy when they don't really have that option to think long term about financial decisions?
Yeah, so that's really where I think building your own awareness of the financial struggles and what financial literacy is so important. And that's really where I think this bill and many other bills that are being passed into law right now are there to address that topic. Because if you look at California being the largest state in the United States, we have the highest number of high school students. And what that means is that these are more students that might be on the very end of the wealth gap, coming from kind of good, wealthy families. And then there's a lot that are on the other end of it. And the only way to kind of make sure that these lessons are kind of brought to everybody to even out the playing field is by mandating something where every school district kind of has to have some teachers doing these lessons as well. And then that'll automatically in the process get students motivated to manage their own finances, pay attention to it, and really bring attention to things that many students and even some adults don't really look at during their day, right? So I'd say it's definitely a public policy kind of way of tackling this issue that's going to be extremely influential for all high school students on both ends of this topic. Whether you need it or not, I think that these lessons are very helpful. And by mandating them, everybody is given the same opportunity to kind of learn these skills and build their own knowledge, foundation of knowledge for the future.
Finally, before I let you go, you know, we're talking about economics, we're talking about finances, and often there isn't a lot of, you don't reflexively think of compassion, but you really are doing this even from the beginning when you talked about why you and your brother started this out of compassion, you know, to help others gain that financial independence and literacy. Where does that compassion come from? And especially when we're talking about money and budgets and things that can be pretty dry.
Yeah. So that compassion, I think, really just comes from a kind of understanding that many people that may not be from the same background as you do not have the same accessibility to many of the things that you may do in your daily life. So the compassion really comes from that. It's a root from knowing that if you have something yourself, or if you've been given a certain kind of skill or piece of knowledge, you are almost, in our case, how we felt. We felt pretty obligated that we wanted to give it back to the community and kind of spread that around, but do it in a fun way. Because obviously, if you're just talking about finances and it's kind of dry topics in many cases, we have to kind of spruce it up, especially because we're dealing with a young audience. You know, they want to stay engaged. They want to have their attention, which many people, in our cases, already have short attention spans. So it's kind of figuring out a way, how do we get them engaged? And that's what we do, prizes and other activities during our teachings. But it's really just it's a mutual feeling between us and the rest of everybody on our team that we are given knowledge either from a young age for any type of reason. And now we want to share that with the rest of the public and kind of get everybody up to speed and kind of help out, lessen that wealth gap in the process.
Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sean Varshney is a high school student in El Dorado County and co-founder of Financial Literacy for You, or FLY for short, a nonprofit which provides peer-to-peer financial literacy for youth. And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Carl Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.